Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has always impressed me with his intelligence, as well as his understanding of the full dimensions of the war for the free world, notably because of his deep knowledge of one of its most challenging fronts, namely in our own hemisphere, and specifically the island of Cuba, which has suffered for decades under the tyranny of communists and is still misruled by the successors to Fidel and Raul Castro. His name is Frank Calzone. He has been for many years associated with freedom-fighting organizations like Freedom House and the Center for a Free Cuba. These days, he's an independent Cuban political scientist, he calls himself, and a great, great resource for us. We're always delighted to have him with us. Frank Calzone, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Frank, I wanted to catch you quickly on a story that came across the wires last week, as I recall, by Paula Zelitsky of the Cuban Studies Institute under the heading, A New Missile Crisis in the Making in Cuba. Talk a little bit about what the Russians, who of course brought us the last missile crisis, may be up to there and whether it's something we should be concerned about.
Well, as I'm sure you have talked to repeatedly, Mr. Putin is reasserting his influence all over the place, not only in Europe and in Crimea, places like that. He has volunteers in Venezuela, and there's a Cuban chapter to that. There have been reports, and this expert that you quote put out an extensive report that says that the Russians are rebuilding a nuclear submarine facility in the south of Cuba.
And they evidently are putting into place, at least in terms of port visits, the rather routine practice of housing or at least hosting Russian warships that are believed to have nuclear weapons aboard. There's talk about having a submarine base that would almost certainly involve such weapons. I've even seen a report in this article by Paulina that there may be missiles armed with nuclear warheads placed on the seabed outside of Cuba in its waters. Any sign that these sorts of things are afoot, Frank? And again, should we be treating this as the sort of threat that we saw it back in the 60s?
Well, it is very, very important to keep an eye on what's happening. I know that there are people on Capitol Hill and in the administration that are very much aware of this report. The Russians returned to Cuba right in the midst of the negotiations when the Obama administration there was a team of Americans that were scheduled to arrive in Havana for the final discussions on normalizing relations with Cuba. And the Russians sent an intelligence ship, a spy ship, docking in Havana Harbor 2 days before the American negotiators arrive, and they stay there, and the Russian spy vessels stay there until 2 days after. So the message was clear: the Americans were reopening the embassies, but the Russians were also coming.
This is, I think, very troubling, and especially we'll be talking more about this with Dan Gallington shortly, a very astute and experienced nuclear weapons expert. But I just want to get your sense of the lay of the land in Cuba and how we should be responding to it, Frank Calzone. Let me turn to a related subject. There are signs that the Cuban people are becoming more restive under the jackboot heels of the communist regime in Havana. Talk a little bit about what you see as the resurgence of civil society and opposition now being expressed by its participants to the regime.
Well, lots of things have happened since Fidel died. The Cuban people now have a lot greater access to the internet. And what happens is the Cubans now know what's going on outside the world. Before, it took months, sometimes years, for the Cubans to know. Now something happens in one end of the island, and at the other end, people know immediately what's going on, almost daily. There are food riots in Cuba. The Cuban government announced as a great success 3 days ago that now Cubans are going to have toothpaste. Every 2 months, they're going to be able to have toothpaste. There are shortages of soap in the middle of the crisis, but the government is using the virus epidemic as a way to increase repression and going after Cuban independent journalists are in prison for having written about the epidemic. There's a lot of public. There were demonstrations at the carnival. There's a group of artists that are demonstrating incredible now in the internet. They're Cuban songs by Cuban popular musicians complaining about the dictatorship, and the cardinal, who was sort of not very critical of the government for many years, died. And there's a new cardinal, a new Catholic cardinal, who asked during Holy Week Cubans to put pictures of Jesus on their front doors, on their windows, and on their balconies. So finally, the Catholic hierarchy is urging Catholics to publicly proclaim that they are religious believers.
And is there evidence that the police state apparatus is cracking down on such demonstrations and evidence of religious belief?
There are lots of videos. What has happened is that maybe a lot of this stuff was happening before, but you couldn't see it. Now it's all over the internet. When the police comes tries to grab someone, and then lots of people are complaining about it. They try to prevent the police from doing that. The food situation is such that the police, their police escorts outside the crowds, because people wait all over during the night for a shop to open up. Also, the Cuban people now know very well that the American embargo is not at fault at all, because the day after the Cuban president, Díaz-Canel, complained that the lack of food was because of the American sanctions, someone from Havana put on the internet photographs of packages of frozen chicken that were being sold in Cuba, and in the back of those packages it said "Made in the USA." So the Cuban people know what's going on. The Cuban government is having a difficult time keeping control of the situation.
Well, we need to intensify the pressure on them, it seems to me, the regime that is, and to help the Cuban people. Frank Calzone, you've done that for your entire life. I appreciate your work so much and your visits with us from time to time, too. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Dan Gallington, as promised, is up next. We'll talk with him about the Cuban Missile Crisis and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined, I'm very pleased to say, by Colonel Dan Gallington, United States Air Force retired, the man who served his country with great distinction, both in uniform and as a civilian, notably in a number of incarnations in the senior executive service of the Defense Department. He was also at the Justice Department. He was also the last bipartisan general counsel for the Senate Intelligence Committee. I'm very pleased to call him a friend and colleague of many years and always a welcome guest here at Secure Freedom Radio. Dan Gallington, glad to have you back.
Thanks. Glad to be here, Frank. Always an honor for me.
Well, thank you. Let me tell you about something that I was just talking about with Frank Calzone to get your take on it, Dan. The Russians have been, under Vladimir Putin, as you know, investing massively in nuclear capabilities, mostly unmatched by us. They have threatened, in the person of Vladimir Putin, to put missiles in Cuba if we put missiles capable of reaching the former Soviet Union, Russia, from Europe, part of our history that you and I spent some good time on. Let me ask you about the implications, as you see it. Were the Russians, in fact, well, to do what they're doing now, for that matter, but perhaps do even more, they're bringing nuclear armed warships into Cuban harbors, but there's talk of even putting missiles with nuclear weapons on them on the ocean floor in Cuban waters. Your thoughts?
Well, you know, when I hear something like that, I always remember it's sort of like deja vu all over again, because Putin, because he was a KGB guy for so many years, certainly remembers the Soviet Union being deterred for so many years back in the 50s and 60s with, you know, our Davy Crockett, Honest John, tripwire nuclear policies there in NATO Europe.
Those were short-range, what we call tactical nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. Tactical nuclear weapons, small ones. And that was precisely the reason for the first Cuban Missile Crisis. The idea was, okay, you have this this band of deterrence here in NATO Europe, which prohibits and prevents us from doing what we want to do, and that's accrete the rest of Europe. And so, therefore, we're going to subject you to the same kind of threat, and we're going to put nukes in Cuba. Well, that's, you know, it really is deja vu all over again. It's the same concept, the same kind of threat. You add to the fact, and you and I have talked about this so many times in the past, is that we sort of just put our heads in the sand for about 20 years after the Iron Curtain fell and the Soviet Union imploded. I guess we just assumed that this was all going to go away and we never had to deal with it again. Wrong.
Wrong indeed, especially under a guy like Putin. And I guess the point, Dan, is that he's taking steps to actually create new threats to this country from an island 90 miles off our shores. We're talking about responding to other threats that he's already put into place to our own forces in Europe as well as our allies. This is, in some ways, as you say, deja vu all over again, but it's happening now, and we seem to be responding to it very differently, certainly than we did under John Kennedy in the 1960s. I think we better be paying much closer attention to it going forward. And more to the point, Dan, as we have talked about quite frequently with you, the need to enhance our deterrent across the board in the face of what Putin's doing, not only with tactical and other theater nuclear weaponry, but his long-range ones that unmistakably are a threat to our homeland. Dan, I want to switch gears, if I can, with you, because another topic that is near and dear to your heart, of course, is our intelligence community. You've worked with it. You've overseen it in various capacities in the past. You write about it frequently, I think, in the Washington Times. And I wondered what you make of this latest set of revelations, specifically in the context of what happened to Lieutenant General Mike Flynn, who I think you've known, as have I, by virtue of the weaponization of our intelligence capabilities in a kind of political warfare against American citizens.
Yeah, I don't think it's kind of a political warfare. I think it is political warfare. If you look at the way the Obama administration behaved, and even if you focus on the period of time between the election and the inauguration, you see essentially a pattern abuse of the requirements and regulations for targeting intelligence topics. And you also see, and I wrote about this 2 years ago, you also see the DNI and the Attorney General agreeing on totally new procedures to allow the release of U.S. person identity and what we call raw SIGINT information. And that was done on 5 January, 15 days before the election, virtually assuring that all of this information would end up leaked to the press. And that's exactly what happened. A big surprise. So when Hillary Clinton talked about the opposition, you know, she was serious about it. And they continued to fight with the deep state and the release, you know, leaking of information. Now, granted, on the other side of this, the Trump campaign, as you know, in those days, a lot of people who were sort of new to the business, the Republican Party was sort of in shambles, as well as the Democrats after the election. And so a lot of these people who came in initially in the transition and the administration were new to the business and didn't realize how vulnerable they would be to this kind of abuse. And they, in fact, were. Papadopoulos, for example, and some of these other people, very junior people who were picked up with conversations with foreigners, and that information was leaked.
Right, and then used to prosecute them, needless to say. Dan, one of the things that has, you know, been striking about all of this is the extent to which it seems the President of the United States himself was involved, Barack Obama, that he certainly was attending some of the meetings in which these matters were discussed. And there's this curious memo that Susan Rice's National Security Advisor, a cover your butt memo if ever there were one, that said he wanted it all by the book. What do you make of the procedures and how they were abused, Dan, by the president himself, the same fellow who, by the way, the other day was decrying what he described as, you know, the violation of institutional norms and the rule of law?
Well, what you get out of all this is that he knew about it. There's no doubt about it. Now, to the extent to which he actually participated in the discussions and actually made decisions, we won't know, or at least we won't know for a while. But we do know that the Attorney General and the DNI did participate, and they did allow these abuses, as you say, of Attorney General procedures and USID 18, which governs the NSA. They allowed these things to go on. So it isn't that Mr. Obama, President Obama, didn't know about these things. He obviously did, and so did apparent Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden.
It does seem that way, doesn't it? Hey, Dan, let me ask you about one other piece of this. Again, you've spent time on Capitol Hill. You were a senior staff member of the general counsel for the Senate Intelligence Committee. I am struck by the absence under the Republicans, most especially under now former chairman of your committee, Richard Burr, of serious oversight of these wrongdoings. If anything, it really seems as though such oversight as there's been done has been complicit with the perpetrators of the conspiracy.
I would agree with that. I'm sort of stunned that particularly the Republican-run SSCI management hasn't been more and more aggressive. Now, maybe they're doing some things, and maybe they're going to announce some particularly pointed investigations they're going to do. But Frank, what we've seen here in the last few months is every bit as significant as Watergate was, and the Church Commission and the Pike Commission. And you could even, as you say, you could even argue that some of the abuses we've seen here are far worse than those during Watergate. But I agree with you. The Senate Select Committee on Intelligence must become more aggressive. And remember when the Democrats ran the committee. Remember what they did against enhanced interrogation. I mean, they ran an investigation for years.
Yeah, and leaked massively. Lastly, Dan, the Judiciary Committee also would have an oversight role here. What do you make as an attorney as well as an experienced policymaker about Chairman Lindsey Graham's contention that he mustn't do any oversight until the prosecutorial process has run its course.
Well, I understand his concern. He looks at it purely from a law enforcement standpoint, and I wasn't involved in that process in the government, so I appreciate his concern. On the other hand, look at 12333, the intelligence executive order, and look at the number and extent of duties that the attorney general has. And when I was at Justice, I was in the business of intelligence oversight. And it's a proactive function, and it was created in the wake of Watergate to allow the American citizenry to feel like that these rules that were placed in for the FBI and the NSA and FISA and all that sort of thing, that these rules were scrupulously adhered to. So I think there is a role for the Judiciary Committee focused on the role and responsibility of the Attorney General in the intelligence gathering process, which is substantial.
Yeah. Dan Dallington, thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate you tremendously as a friend and colleague. I look forward to talking with you soon.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We look forward to this moment each week with great expectation. It is our visit with Gordon Chang. He is our duty expert on China and that of much of the rest of the free world, I'm happy to say. You see him frequently at Fox and in various print outlets. You, I hope, are familiar by now with his three terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and Losing South Korea. He is also contributing to a new book coming out from the Center for Security Policy Press about biological warfare and what China has been doing to us and more. Be sure to follow Gordon Chang on Twitter at Gordon G. Chang. Gordon, I'm glad to have you with us. Welcome back. Let's start with a breaking news item. Yesterday, Gordon, 51 former officials, military leaders, China subject matter experts, religious leaders, and others came together behind a letter, I'm very pleased to say, the Committee on the Present Danger China helped facilitate, that was sent off to the Securities and Exchange Commission chairman and the chairman of something called the PCAOB, the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, urging that China be compelled to comply to the same laws and accounting standards and regulations that anybody else in our capital markets has to address and conform to. Gordon, your thoughts on the importance of this seemingly basic principle of you want our money, you've got to play by our rules.
Well, certainly, Frank. I mean, it was inexplicable to me why China would get exemptions from U.S. rules that everybody else had to comply with. And this is sort of this notion of Chinese exceptionalism, that China rules the world and so it can do whatever it wants and that other countries don't have sovereignty. So eliminating the exemptions for Chinese companies is just an essential first step to reaffirming American sovereignty. It's as basic as that. And of course, there are issues regarding the ability of investors to understand what they're actually buying. So, you know, these exemptions should never have existed in the first place.
They shouldn't have. And hopefully, with what President Trump did last week in blocking the federal retirement system from investing in these Chinese companies, the stage will be set for helping other people at least ensure that they're doing so, if they do, with full knowledge of the material risks and financial realities of these companies. It seems, as I say, a no-brainer. Gordon, let me turn to a couple of things that have happened or are happening as we speak. The World Health Assembly is having its annual meeting. This is a gathering sponsored by the now highly controversial World Health Organization. There's talk about the Trump administration seeking to use that meeting to talk up the need for an investigation of how the WHO has been performing. What do you know about what's going on there, and what do you think the likely upshot of it will be?
More than 100 countries have called for an independent investigation of China and the World Health Organization and matters relating to the disease. Xi Jinping, at the invitation of Dr. Tedros, the Director General of the World Health Organization, spoke at the opening session, and he said that China supports an investigation after the pandemic is over. And this is consistent with what Chinese officials in Geneva have been saying for quite some time. So this is, in a sense, nothing new. But it is an attempt to forestall the investigation, an independent investigation. So that is, I think, the most important thing at the World Health Assembly meeting. The second most important thing, and it's close, is Taiwan's admission. That probably will not happen. Taiwan in the past was an observer at the WHA, which is the decision-making body for the World Health Organization. It now is not. The U.S. and others have been pressing for it to be readmitted as an observer. I actually think it should be a full member, and China should be expelled, especially because we know that China took steps that inevitably led to the spreading of the disease beyond China's borders. So this was a deliberate act, which has now killed hundreds of thousands of people.
So the World Health Assembly is discussing an investigation of China, not an investigation of the World Health Organization itself and how it has conducted itself in this matter. It seems to me that investigation's needed there too, no?
Well, the wording of the proposals have really included an investigation of the WHO and China and the origins of the coronavirus. So it's a full investigation. And indeed, the idea that Xi Jinping and not President Trump at the same time would be invited to speak to the WHA is troubling, and it shows Beijing's control over that multilateral body. Xi Jinping also pledged about $2 billion to the WHO over a two-year period. And, of course, he talked about the common destiny of mankind, two references to that. So it was a propaganda speech, and it's meant to forestall an independent investigation at this time.
And, Gordon, do you anticipate that that will be the outcome, given the money that Beijing is showering on the place and the fact that Tedros is his puppet?
I don't know how this is going to come out, Frank. There is, of course, a lot of pressure for an investigation. But China has made it very clear that it is determined to oppose that. So how this turns out tomorrow is, to me, a big mystery.
Let me turn to another topic that I know you're watching closely. Gordon, there was a decision taken late last week by the United States that is intended, clearly, to further intensify pressure on Huawei. Tell us what the decision was and whether it's likely to have that effect.
Well, the Commerce Department has required companies that want to sell or license to Huawei and use U.S. chip-making equipment to get a license from the Commerce Department. But there's a 120-day exemption or deferral of that rule. And I actually don't think at this point that any deferrals were justified. There's also going to be another exemption for rural American telecom companies to be able to keep their Huawei equipment until August 13th, though Commerce said that this is the last deferral that rural companies are going to get.
The idea being to let them phase in the replacement of those parts without disrupting service, I take it.
Yes, but this rule on rip and replace goes back to last year, and there have been a number of deferrals on this. And so this has been a long, drawn-out period where Huawei has gotten a lot of deferrals from Commerce. And this really has been the story that Commerce Department has announced stringent rules, but has given excessive time for companies to comply with them.
Michael Pillsbury has been on Maria Bartiromo's show a couple of times talking about the Chinese response to all of this, and indeed more broadly, I guess, our response to the coronavirus that they unleashed on us, the CCP virus, I call it. Do you think, Gordon, that they read what we say and the contrast with what we actually do as proof that either we are so irresolute or simply fearful of them and weak that it's a matter of ridicule?
I think that Beijing right now looks at the United States and looks at specifically at the Trump administration as certainly hostile, But also, they do believe that they can use elements of the business community and the academic community to pressure the administration not to do what it would otherwise want. And so, therefore, you've got all these exemptions. So there's a sense of weakness of the American system in general, and they're, of course, exploiting it. And we can expect that in the run-up to the November 3 election, there's going to be a big Chinese push to influence votes. Well, let me put it bluntly, they're going to be supporting the Democratic nominee for president.
And the expectation that all of the things, even the rhetorical things that the Trump administration has been doing, will go by the wayside. And Gordon, let me just ask you, corruption is one of the other things that Michael Pillsbury has suggested is operating here. Their confidence that they've bought off or otherwise can rely upon a sort of self-interest on the part of a China lobby in this country. And that's one of the reasons why we're so concerned about their penetration of our capital markets, the numbers of American investors who are potentially exposed to being pressured in this way is huge. And it's something that does need to be addressed, I think, rather urgently. Let me ask you about one other thing. Speaking of that pressure, the Global Times, one of the principal propaganda arms of the Chinese Communist Party, is boasting that there will be the biggest counterattack mounted by China to any pressure along these lines, including specific pressure on companies that are keen to do business in China, some of which they have already named and are, I think, suggesting are unreliable partners, which presumably means that the Chinese companies that do business with them will cease to do so. Talk us through that quickly, if you would, Gordon.
Yeah, the Global Times suggested a couple days ago that in retaliation for the Trump administration's moves on Huawei, they are going to add American companies to their quote-unquote unreliable entity list, which means essentially that they will be subject to harassment and endless investigations. And the companies that they named were Cisco, Apple, Qualcomm, as being added to the unreliable entities list. And they also said they were going to go after Boeing. This is, you know, China does this all the time, and I'm not so sure that this is new, but what is new is the rhetorical component to it, and I do expect that American companies are going to be pushed out of China, and American dependents in China should leave. China's taken hostages, including children, so this is a time for people who do business there either to leave themselves, but certainly to take husbands, wives, children, parents, and get them out of China so they're out of harm's way.
A chilling thought, Gordon Chang, as so many of yours are, but they're very, very important, and we appreciate your sharing them with us each week. Thank you for your time today, my friend. Come back to us again next week, if you will. Next up, we'll speak with Todd Bensman of the Center for Immigration Studies. We'll get into the latest on migrants, who may actually be terrorists instead. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. It's a privilege to say, joined by Todd Bensman, who is a very impressive man with a lot of exciting things to his credit in terms of journalism, in terms of working with the law enforcement community in Texas, where he hails from. These days, he is a senior fellow with an organization that I regard very highly. Actually, he's associated with a couple of them, but I'm thinking of the Center for Immigration Studies, where he's a senior fellow. He's also a writing fellow with the Middle East Forum, and he contributes to the public policy debate, not only through those channels, but also at The Federalist and as a political columnist for Town Hall. Always delighted to have him with us. Todd, thank you for joining us again. Welcome back.
Yeah, good to be here.
Let me ask you to talk about a couple of things that you've been writing about. They sort of fit into the larger rubric of immigration as a challenge, but one that particularly caught my eye was your report about how terrorists have been using the cover of migrants to penetrate various countries, presumably ours as well. But you focused on Europe in a piece at the Center for Immigration Studies the other day, and I wanted to sort of both ask you about what's happening there and whether it is, in fact, a problem here as well.
Sure. Well, there's a new terrorist travel tactic on the global stage that is still not very widely acknowledged yet in homeland security circles, and certainly not around the voting public. And that is that terrorist organizations, particularly ISIS, have figured out that they can penetrate over borders through migration tactics, posing as refugees and asylum seekers. And this has been happening on a kind of industrial scale in Europe now since about 2014, 2015, became obvious when with the attacks on Paris and Brussels in November 2015 and then March 2016, where almost all of those attackers, suicide bombers, et cetera, had camouflaged themselves among refugees from Syria posing as migrants and claiming asylum coming right in over the border. And I did a study for this for CIS published in November where I tried to quantify. Nobody's really tried to quantify how often this has happened, but I found that 104 violent jihadists had penetrated into Europe and conducted attacks and were arrested for plots or were killed trying to do them. And the study was through 2018, but I noticed that terrorists are continuing to penetrate Europe's borders in this manner. They haven't been able to stop it. And five Tajikis were recently arrested for plotting to bomb U.S. air bases. So we need to care about this in the United States. In Germany, they were thankfully apprehended. And then around the same time in April, one of Europe's most wanted jihadists, the so-called ISIS rapper, and that's what I wrote about, his name is Abdelmajed Abdelbari, very highly wanted, murdering, decapitating thug, highly wanted around the world, went in on a migrant boat and landed in Spain and got into the country and was in for about a week before they finally caught up to him. And these cases are just continuing on despite Europe's best efforts. And I just advocate that we need to start paying attention and acknowledge as a country that the use of migration over borders and asylum or taking advantage of asylum processes is something that we need to pay attention to at our own border.
No doubt about it. And to what extent are we paying attention to it, Todd? You know, the president speaks fairly frequently about having locked down our border. And obviously, as you know so well, having spent a lot of time on and working with the Department of Public Safety and others in Texas, it's a pretty porous border. I think what he means is we've locked down the formal points of entry, but how are we doing with respect to keeping folks like those you're talking about out? Is there any way of saying?
Yeah, well, every year we apprehend about 3,000 or 4,000 migrants from the same countries, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, that have been apprehended or caught attacking in Europe at our border. So there are smuggling bridges that connect those countries with our border. They come in illegally. We don't know who they are any more than the Europeans did. So there is a threat there. We do screen. We have processes in place. We try to ICE, Homeland Security Investigations, tries to bust up the smuggling organizations that bring these guys in. They've had some success, but we've also had a number of jihadists come through. We had a Somali come through the California border and go on to Canada and conduct a double vehicle ramming attack in 2017 in Edmonton. So there are cases. Right now, nobody's getting through. This is a great time what we've done for to prevent that kind of penetration by shutting down a lot of the routes through Mexico and Guatemala and into our border. We're just turning them all back right now, but that's temporary. That's going to go away as soon as the COVID virus thing goes away. And those migrants from special interest countries will continue to be able to get to our border. And I think we should do a lot more. We should be doing a lot more to vet. There are problems, holes in that net. I've written about this. It's probably too complicated to get into right here.
No, but I think you've done a really good job of sort of making clear what the stakes are. And I just want to commend to people you're writing at, well, most immediately, I guess, the Center for Immigration Studies, CIS.org, and of course, your other outlets, notably PJ Media. Todd, let me talk to you about one other thing quickly. Speaking of terrorists, there was one evidently operating as a doctor in the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, in what he characterized to, fortunately, some of our law enforcement personnel as behind enemy lines, meaning here. Tell us about that story and, again, the broader insights that teaches us about some of these folks, at least, perhaps operating here as professionals, no less, using H-1 visas to gain entrance to our country.
Yeah, well, this is a very disturbing story that was almost missed. I think it was completely missed, actually, because of the COVID story, the lockdown story. But a Pakistani came in, who's a doctor, a medical doctor, licensed in Pakistan, came in on an H-1B visa in 2018 to work at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. And from the day he arrived, this is all according to court records and FBI affidavits, from almost the day he got here, he planned to do jihad. He was going to use his visa to get behind enemy lines, according to him. Luckily, when he reached out to other jihadists, some of them were turned out to be undercover FBI people, thank God. So he decided that instead of attacking at the Mayo Clinic or, you know, killing all the people around him during COVID, by the way, that he was going to try to go back overseas to Iran or Afghanistan and join ISIS there. And they caught him on the way and arrested him. But Frank, the issue here really is that the demographics of terrorists who are apprehended and caught and busted here in the United States often are that they are highly trained and educated engineers and doctors. So when we hand out H-1B visas, which are intended for well-trained, skilled workers to come in, and they're a doctor, so we don't typically, it's a doctor, let them go to the United States to save lives. They have this sort of aura of credibility that reduces the inclination to vet them very, very well. And that's what this case shows to me, that, you know, our vetting process, and I wrote about what the vetting processes are for H-1B people from countries of terror concern. And they're about the same as if you were a tourist going to Disneyland.
Todd, thank you for your work at the Center for Immigration Studies and the Middle East Forum, and for joining us from time to time. I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.